If the Forsaken caught a suspicion of what he was up to, or the White Tower did, they would find some way to overturn the anvil on his feet. At least I can give the Tower's eyes and ears less to talk about. This time I'm burning that bloody banner. And the wolf head, too. He might have to play at being a lord, but he could do it without a bloody flag. Fail's full lips pursed judiciously, and she shook her head slightly. Slipping from her chair, she knelt beside him, took his wrist in her hands. Perrin met her level gaze warily. When she looked at him so intently, so seriously, she was about to tell him something important. That, or pull the wool over his eyes and spin him around till he did not know front from back. Her scent told him nothing. He tried to stop smelling her. It was all too easy to lose himself in that. And then she would pull the wool over his eyes. One thing he had learned since marrying, a man needed all of his wits dealing with a woman. Too often even that was not enough. Women did what they wanted as surely as Aes Sedai.
"You might want to reconsider, husband," she murmured.
A tiny smile quirked her mouth as if she once again knew what he was thinking.
"I doubt anyone who's seen us since we entered Gil-Dan knew what the Red Eagle is. Around a town the size of Bethal, some will, though. And the longer we have to hunt for Massima, the greater the chance."
He did not bother with saying that was all the more reason to get rid of the banner. Fail was no fool, and she thought much faster than he.
"Then why keep it?" he asked slowly.
"When all it'll do is draw eyes to the idiot everybody will think is trying to pull Manethrin out of the grave." Men had tried that in the past, and women, too. The name of Manethrin carried powerful memories, and it was convenient for anyone who wanted to start a rebellion.
"Because it will draw eyes."
She leaned toward him intently.
"To a man trying to raise up Manethrin again. Lesser folk will smile to your face, hope you ride on soon, and try to forget you as soon as you do. As for the greater, they've too much in front of their faces right now to look twice unless you pinch their noses. Compared to the Shan Chan or the Prophet or the White Cloaks, a man trying to raise Manethrin is small turnips. And I think it's safe to say the Tower won't look twice either, not now."
Her smile widened, and the light in her eyes said she was about to make her most telling point.
"But most important, no one will think that man is doing anything else."
Abruptly her smile vanished. She stuck a finger against his nose, hard.
"And don't call yourself an idiot, Perrin Tabashir Ibarra. Not even sideways like that. You aren't, and I do not like it."
Her scent was tiny spikes, not true anger, but definitely displeased. Quicksilver, a kingfisher flashing by faster than thought, certainly faster than his thoughts. It would never have occurred to him to hide so flagrantly. But he could see the sense. It was like concealing the fact that you were a murderer by claiming to be a thief. Yet it might work. Chuckling, he kissed her fingertip.
"The banner stays," he said.
He supposed that meant the wolf head did too.
Blood and bloody ashes.
"Alejandra has to know the truth, though. If she thinks Rand means to set me up as king of Anethrin and take her lands..." Fail rose so suddenly, turning away, that he was afraid he had made a mistake bringing up the queen. Alejandra could lead to Berylane all too easily, and Fail smelled prickly, wary. But what she said over her shoulder was, "Alejandra won't be a bit of trouble for Perrin Goldeneyes. That bird's as good as netted, husband. So it's time to put our minds on how to find Massima." Kneeling gracefully beside a small chest against the tent wall, the only chest without draperies, she lifted the lid and began removing rolled maps. Perrin hoped she was right about Alejandra, because he did not know what to do if she was wrong. If only he were half what she thought him. Alejandra was a netted bird, the Shan Chan would fall over like dolls for Perrin Goldeneyes, and he would snatch up the Prophet and take him to Rand if Massima had 10,000 men around him. Not for the first time he realized that however much her anger hurt and confused him, it was her disappointment he feared. If he ever saw that in her eyes, it would rip the heart out of his chest. He knelt beside her and helped her spread out the largest map covering the south of Gildan and the north of Amadicia, and studied it as though Massima's name would leap off the parchment at him. He had more reason than Rand to want to succeed. Whatever else, he could not fail Fail.
Fail lay in the darkness, listening until she was sure that Perrin's breath had the deep rhythm of sleep, then slipped out from the blankets they shared. Rueful amusement touched her as she pulled her linen nightdress up over her head. Did he really think she would not find out that he had hidden the bed deep in a copse one morning while the carts were being loaded? Not that she minded. Not a great deal, at least. She was sure she had slept on the ground as often as he. She had pretended surprise, of course, and made light of it. Anything else, and he would have apologized, perhaps even gone back to fetch the bed. Managing a husband was an art, so her mother said. Had Dira ni Galeen ever found it so difficult? Scuffing her bare feet into slippers, she shrugged into a silk robe, then hesitated, looking down at Perrin. He would be able to see her clearly if he woke, but to her he was just a shadowed mound. She wished her mother were there now to advise her. She loved Perrin with every fiber of her being, and he confused every fiber. Actually understanding men was impossible, of course, but he was so unlike anyone she had grown up with. He never swaggered, and instead of laughing at himself, he was modest. She had not believed a man could be modest. He insisted that only chance had made him a leader, claimed he did not know how to lead, when men who met him were ready to follow after an hour. He dismissed his own thinking as slow, when those slow, considering thoughts saw so deeply that she had to dance a merry jig to keep any secrets at all. He was a wonderful man, her curly-haired wolf, so strong and so gentle. Sighing, she tiptoed from the tent. His ears had caused her difficulties before. The camp lay quiet beneath a gibbous moon that gave as much light in a cloudless sky as it normally would have full, a brightness that washed out the stars. Some sort of nightbird cried shrilly, then fell silent at an owl's deep hoot. There was a small breeze, and for a wonder it actually seemed a little cool, probably her imagination. The nights were cool only in comparison to the days. Most of the men were asleep, dark humps among the shadows beneath the trees. A few remained awake, talking around the handful of fires still burning. She made no effort to hide, but none noticed her. Some appeared half asleep where they sat, heads nodding. If she had not known how well the men on sentry duty would be keeping watch, she might have thought the camp could be surprised by a herd of wild cattle. Of course the maidens would be on guard in the night, too, but it did not matter if they saw her either. The high-wheeled carts made long, shadowed rows, the servants already snug and snoring beneath, most of the servants. One fire still crackled there. Magdin and her friends sat around it. Talanvor was talking, gesturing fiercely, but only the other men seemed to be paying him any mind, though he appeared to be addressing himself to Magdin. That they had had better garb in their bundles than those near rags was not surprising, but their former mistress must have had a very free hand to give out silk to her people, and Magdin wore finely cut silk indeed, in a muted blue. None of the others was dressed so well, so perhaps Magdin had been their lady's favorite. A twig snapped under Fael's foot, and heads whipped around, Talanvor starting to his feet, half-drawing his sword before he saw her gathering her robe in the moonlight. They were more alert than the Two Rivers men behind her. For an instant the lot of them just stared at her, then Magdin rose gracefully and made a deep curtsy, and the others hastily followed her example with varying degrees of skill. Only Magdin and Balwer appeared at all at ease. A nervous smile split Gil's round face. "Go on with what you were doing," Fael told them kindly. "But don't stay up too late. Tomorrow will be full." She walked on, but when she glanced back they were still standing, still peering after her. Their travels must have made them wary as rabbits, always watching for a fox. She wondered how well they would fit in. Over the next few weeks she would be busy training them to her ways, learning theirs. One was as important as the other for a well-run household. The time would have to be found. They did not stay long in her thoughts, though. Soon she was beyond the carts, not quite out to where Two Rivers men would be keeping sharp watch from up in the trees. Nothing larger than a mouse would get by them unseen. Even some of the maidens had been spotted upon occasion, but they were watching for anyone attempting to sneak in. Not for those who had a right to be there. In a small moonlit clearing, her people were waiting. Some of the men bowed, and Perilean nearly went to one knee before stopping himself. Several women instinctively made curtsies that looked quite peculiar in men's garb, then dropped their eyes or shifted in embarrassment at realizing what they had done. The manners of the court had been bred into them, though they tried very hard to adopt Aiel customs. What they believed were Aiel customs, at least. Sometimes they horrified the maidens with what they believed. Perrin called them fools, and they were, in some ways, but they had sworn fealty to her, these Kyrianen and Tyrans. Water oath, they named it, copying the Aiel, trying to, and that made them hers. Among themselves, they had taken to calling their society Cha-Fail, the Falcon's Talon, though they had seen the necessity of keeping that quiet. They were not fools in all ways. In fact, around the edges, anyway, they were not too unlike the young men and women she had grown up with. Those she had sent off early that morning had just returned, for the women among them were still changing out of the dresses they had worn of necessity. Even one woman dressed as a man would have roused notice in Bethal, not to mention five. The clearing was a great flurry of skirts and shifts, coats and shirts and breeches. The women made believe they did not mind being unclothed in front of others, including men, since the Aiel apparently did not, but haste and labored breathing gave them the lie. The men were all shifting feet and turning heads, torn between looking away decently and watching as they thought the Aiel did, while pretending they were not looking at half-dressed women. Fail held her robe close over her nightdress. She could not have dressed further without waking Perrin for sure, but she made no pretense at comfort. She was no Damani to receive her retainers in her bath. "Forgive us for being late, my lady Fail," Salanda panted, tugging her coat on. The accents of Kyrian were sharp in the short woman's voice. Even for a Kyrianan, she was not tall. She managed a credible swagger, though, a suitable boldness in the tilt of her head and the set of her shoulders. "We would have returned sooner, but the gate guards made a bother letting us out." "A bother?" Fail said sharply. If only she could have seen with her own eyes on top of theirs. If only Perrin had let her go instead of that trollop. No, she would not think about Berylaine. It was not Perrin's fault. She repeated that to herself 20 times a day, like a prayer. But why was the man so blind? "What kind of bother?" She drew a chagrined breath. Troubles with your husband should never affect your tone with your vassals. "Nothing of note, my lady." Salanda buckled her sword belt and settled it on her hips. "They let some fellows ahead of us drive their wagons through without a second look, but they were worried about letting women go out into the night." Some of the other women laughed. The 5 men who had gone into Bethal stirred irritably, no doubt because they had not been thought enough protection. The rest of Cha-Fail made a thick semicircle behind those 10, watching Fail closely, listening closely. Moonlight shadowed their faces. "Tell me what you saw," Fail commanded in a calmer tone. "Much better." Salanda made her report concisely, and for all Fail's wishes that she had gone herself, she had to admit they had seen almost as much as she could have wished. The streets of Bethal were nearly empty even at the busiest hours of the day. People stayed to their own homes as much as possible. A little commerce trickled in and out, but few merchants ventured into this part of Gildan, and barely enough food came in from the countryside to keep everyone fed. Most of the townspeople seemed stunned, afraid of what lay outside the walls, sinking deeper and deeper into apathy and despair. Everyone kept their mouths closed for fear of the prophet's spies, and their eyes as well, for fear of being taken for spies. The prophet had a deep effect. For instance, however many bandits roamed the hills, cut purses and footpads had vanished from Bethal. It was said the prophet's penalty for a thief was to cut off the man's hands, though that did not seem to apply to his own people. "The queen tours the city every day, showing herself to keep spirits up," Salanda said. "But I do not think it helps much. She is making a progress here in the south to remind people they have a queen. Maybe she has had more success elsewhere. The watch has been added to the wall guards and all but a handful of her soldiers, too. Perhaps it makes the townsfolk feel safer. Until she moves on. Unlike everyone else, Alejandra herself apparently feels no fear the prophet will come storming over the walls. She walks alone in the gardens of Lord Telabin's palace, morning and evening, and keeps only a few soldiers, who spend most of their time in the kitchens. Everybody in the city seems as concerned with food, with how long there will be enough, as they are with the prophet. In truth, my lady, for all the guards on the walls, I think if Massima appeared at the gates alone, they might give him the town. They would, Miralda put in contemptuously, buckling her own sword round her waist, and beg for mercy. Dark and stocky, Miralda was as tall as Fail, but the Tyran woman ducked her head at a frown from Salanda and murmured an apology. There were no doubts who led Shah Fail, after Fail herself. She had been pleased there was no need to change the precedents they had established. Salanda was the brightest of them, except perhaps for Perleon, and only Arala and Camilla were quicker. And Salanda had something extra, a steadiness, as if she had already faced the worst fear in her life and nothing could ever be that bad again. Of course, she wanted a scar like those some of the maidens had. Fail possessed several small scars, badges of honor, most of them, but actually seeking one was idiocy. At least the woman was not too very eager in the matter. We made a map, as you required, my lady, the diminutive woman finished with a last warning glance at Miralda. We marked out Lord Telebin's palace on the back as much as we could, but I fear that is not much more than the gardens and stables. Fail did not try to make out the lines on the paper she unfolded in the moonlight. A pity she had not been able to go herself. She could have mapped the interior, too. No, done was done, as Perrin liked to say, and it was enough. You are certain no one searches wagons leaving the city? Even in the pale light she could see confusion on many of the faces in front of her. None knew why she had sent some of them into Bethal. Salanda did not look confused. Yes, my lady, she said calmly, quite bright, and more than quick enough. The wind gusted for a moment, rustling leaves on the trees, rustling dead leaves on the ground, and Fail wished she had Perrin's ears, his nose and eyes, too. It did not matter if anyone saw her here with her retainers, but eavesdroppers would be something else. You've done very well, Salanda. All of you have. Perrin knew the dangers here, as real as any farther south. He knew, but like most men, he thought with his heart as often as his head. A wife had to be practical to keep her husband out of trouble. That had been her mother's very first piece of advice on married life. At first light, you will return to Bethal, and if you receive word from me, this is what you will do. Even Salanda's eyes widened in shock as she went on, but no one murmured the slightest protest. Fail would have been surprised if anyone had. Her instructions were to the point. There would be some danger, but under the circumstances not nearly what might have been. Are there any questions? She said finally. Does everyone understand? With one voice, Chaf Fail answered. We live to serve our Lady Fail. And that meant they would serve her beloved wolf, whether he wanted them to or not. Megdin shifted in her blankets on the hard ground, sleep eluding her. That was her name now, a new name for a new life. Megdin for her mother, and Dorlane for a family on an estate that had been hers. A new life for an old life gone, but ties of the heart could not be cut. And now... A faint crackle of dead leaves brought her head up, and she watched a dim shape pass through the trees. The Lady Fail, returning to her tent from wherever she had gone. A pleasant young woman, kind-hearted and well-spoken. Whatever her husband's stock, she almost certainly was nobly born, but young, inexperienced. That might be a help. Megdin let her head fall back on the cloak she had wadded up for a pillow. Light! What was she doing here, taking service as a lady's maid? No. She would hold on to her confidence in herself, at least. She could still find that. She could, if she dug deeply. Her breath caught at the sound of footsteps close by. Talonvor knelt gracefully at her side. He was shirtless, moonlight gleaming on the smooth muscles of his chest and shoulders, his face in shadows. A slight breeze ruffled his hair. "What madness is this?" he asked softly. "Entering service? What are you up to? And don't tell me that nonsense about making a new life. I don't believe it. No one does." She tried to turn away, but he laid a hand on her shoulder. He exerted no pressure, yet it stopped her as surely as a halter. "Light, please let her not tremble." The light did not listen, but at least she managed to keep her voice steady. "If you haven't noticed, I must make my way in the world now. Better as a lady's maid than a tavern maid. You may feel free to go on alone if service here doesn't suit." "You didn't abdicate your wits or your pride when you gave up the throne," he muttered. "Burn Linny for revealing that. If you mean to pretend that you did, I suggest you avoid letting Linny get you alone." The man chuckled at her. He chuckled, oh, so richly. "She wants a word with Megdin, and I suspect she won't be as gentle with Megdin as she was with Morgaze." Angrily she sat up, brushing his hand away. "Are you blind, and deaf as well? The Dragon Reborn has plans for Elaine. Light, I wouldn't like it if he simply knew her name. It must be more than chance that brought me to one of his henchmen, Talonvor. It has to be." "Burn me, I knew it must be that. I hoped I was wrong, but—" He sounded as angry as she. He had no right to be angry. "Elaine is safe in the White Tower. The Ammerlin's seat won't let her anywhere near a man who can channel, even if he is the Dragon Reborn, especially if he is. And Megdin Dorlane can do nothing about the Ammerlin's seat, the Dragon Reborn, or the Lion Throne. All she can do is get her neck snapped or her throat cut or—" "Megdin Dorlane can watch," she broke in, at least partly to stop that awful litany. "She can listen. She can—" Irritably, she trailed off. What could she do? Suddenly she realized she was sitting there in a thin shift, and hurriedly folded her blankets around her. The night actually seemed a little cool. Or maybe the goosebumps on her skin were from Talonvor's unseen eyes on her. The thought roused a flush in her cheeks she hoped he could not see. Luckily it put a heat in her voice, too. She was not a girl to go blushing because a man looked at her. "I will do what I can, whatever that is. The chance will come to learn something or do something that will help Elaine, and I will take it." "A dangerous decision," he told her calmly. She wished she could make out his face in the darkness, only to read his expression, of course. "You heard him threaten to hang anyone who looked at him the wrong way. I can believe it in a man with those eyes, like a beast. I was surprised he let that fellow go. I thought he'd rip his throat out. If he discovers who you are, who you used to be, Balwer might betray you. He never really explained why he helped us escape, Amador. Maybe he thought Queen Morgaze would give him a new position. Now he knows there's no chance of that, and he might want to curry favor with his new master and mistress." "Are you afraid of Lord Perrin Goldeneyes?" she demanded contemptuously. Light, the man frightened her. Those eyes belonged on a wolf. "Balwer knows enough to hold his tongue. Anything he says will reflect on him. He came with me, after all. If you're afraid, then ride on." "You always fling that in my face," he sighed, settling back on his heels. She could not see his eyes, but she could feel them. "Ride on if you wish, you say. Once there was a soldier loved a queen from afar. Knowing it was hopeless, knowing he could never dare speak. Now the queen is gone, and only a woman remains, and I hope. I burn with hope. If you want me to leave, Megdin, say it. One word. Go. A simple word." She opened her mouth. "A simple word," she thought. "Light, it's only one word. Why can't I say it? Light, please." For the second time that night, the light failed to hear. She sat there, huddled in her blankets like a fool, her mouth open, her face growing hotter and hotter. If he had chuckled again, she would have put her belt knife in him, if he had laughed or given any sign of triumph. Instead, he leaned forward and gently kissed her eyes. She made a sound deep in her throat. She could not seem to move. Wide-eyed, she watched him stand. He loomed in the moonlight. She was a queen. She had been a queen. Used to command. Used to hard decisions in hard times. But right then the pounding of her heart drummed thought from her head. "Had you said go," he told her, "I'd have buried hope, but I could never leave you." Not until he was back in his own blankets could she make herself lie down and draw hers around her. She breathed as if she had been running. The night was cool. She was shivering, not trembling. Talonvor was young, too young. Worse, he was right. Burn him for that. A lady's maid could do nothing to affect events. And if the Dragon Reborn's wolf-eyed killer learned that he had Morghese of Andor in his hands, she could be used against Elaine instead of helping her. He had no right to be right when she wanted him to be wrong. The illogic of that thought infuriated her. There was a chance she might do some good. There had to be. In the back of her head, a small voice laughed. "You can't forget that you're Morghese Trakand," it told her scornfully. "And even after she's abdicated her throne, Queen Morghese can't stop trying her hand in the affairs of the mighty, no matter how much ruin she's made of it so far. And she can't tell a man to go away, either, because she can't stop thinking how strong his hands are and how his lips curve when he smiles." And, furious, she pulled the blanket over her head, trying to shut out the voice. She was not staying because she could not walk away from power. As for Talonvor, she would set him firmly in his place. This time she would. But what was his place with a woman who was no longer a queen? She tried to put him out of her mind, and tried to ignore that mocking voice that would not be quiet, yet when sleep finally came, she could still feel the pressure of his lips on her eyelids.
Chapter 9. Tangles. Perrin woke before first light, as usual, and as usual, Fael was already up and about. She could make a mouse seem noisy when she wanted to, and he suspected that if he woke an hour after lying down, she would still manage to be up first. The door flaps were tied back, the side panels raised a little at the bottom, and a stir of air rose through the vent hole in the peak, enough to create an illusion of coolness. Perrin actually shivered while searching for his shirt and breeches. Well, it was supposed to be winter, even if the weather did not know it. He dressed in the dark and scrubbed his teeth with salt, needing no lamps, and when he left the tent, stamping his feet into his boots, Fael had her new servants gathered around her in the deep grayness of early morning, some holding lighted lanterns. A lord's daughter needed servants. He should have arranged for it before this. There were two rivers folk in Camelin that Fael had trained herself, but with the need for secrecy, there had been no way to fetch them along. Master Gil would want to go home as soon as possible, and Lamgwyn and Brianna with him. But maybe Megden and Linny would stay. Aram straightened from where he had been sitting cross-legged beside the tent and waited silently on Perrin. If Perrin had not stopped him, Aram would have slept across the entrance. This morning his coat was striped red and white, though the white was a trifle dingy, and even here that wolf-head pummeled sword-hilt rose over his shoulder. Perrin had left his axe in the tent, and grateful to be rid of it. Talonvor still wore his sword belted over his coat, but not Master Gil or the other two. Fael must have been watching, because no sooner did Perrin come out than she gestured toward the tent, clearly issuing orders. Megden and Brianna came bustling past him and Aram with lanterns, their jaws set, smelling of determination for some reason. Neither curtsied, a pleasant surprise. Linny did, a quick bend of the knee before she darted after the other two, muttering about knowing their place. Perrin suspected Linny was one of those women who saw her place as being in charge. Come to think of it, most women did. That was the way of the world, it seemed, not just the two rivers. Talonvor and Lamgwyn followed close behind the women, and Lamgwyn was as serious about bowing as Talonvor, who was almost grim. Perrin sighed and bowed back, and they both gave a start, gaping at him. A curt shout from Linny jerked them into the tent. With only a quickly flashed smile for him, Fael strode off toward the carts, talking alternately to Basil Gill on one side of her, and Seben Balwer on the other. The men each held a lantern out to light her way. Of course, a double handful of those idiots kept pace where they could hear if she raised her voice, strutting and stroking sword hilts and staring about in the dimness as though they expected an attack or hoped for one. Perrin tugged at his short beard. She always found plenty of work to fill her hours, and nobody took it out of her hands. Nobody would dare. Not so much as the first fingers of dawn showed on the horizon yet, but the Cariennan were beginning to stir around the carts, and moving more quickly the closer Fayul came. By the time she reached them, they appeared to be trotting, their lanterns bobbing and swinging in the dimness. The two rivers men, used to farmers' days, were already making breakfast, some laughing and roughhousing around their cook fires, some grumping, but most getting the work done. A few tried to stay in their blankets and were unceremoniously tumbled out. Grady and Neild were up, too, as always off by themselves, shadows in black coats among the trees. Perrin could not recall seeing them without those coats, always buttoned to the neck, always clean and unwrinkled come sunrise, whatever they had looked like the night before. Stepping through the forms in unison, the pair were practicing the sword as they did every morning. That was better than their evening practice, when they would sit cross-legged, hands on knees, staring at some distant nothing. They never did anything that anyone could see, yet not a man in the camp but knew what they were about and kept as far off as possible. Not even the maidens would step into their line of sight then. Something was missing, Perrin realized with a start. Fayul always had one of the men meet him first thing with a bowl of the thick porridge they breakfasted on, but it seemed she had been too busy this morning. Brightening, he hurried toward the cook fires, hoping at least to be able to dip his own porridge for once. A small hope. Glan Barstier, a lanky fellow with a dent in his chin, met him halfway and shoved a carved bowl into his hands. Flan was from up toward Watch Hill, and Perrin did not know him well, but they had been hunting together a time or two, and once Perrin had helped him dig one of his father's cows out of a bog hole in the Waterwood.
"The lady Fayul told me to bring this to you, Perrin," Flan said anxiously. "You won't tell her I forgot, will you? You won't tell? I found some honey, and I put in a good dollop."
Perrin tried not to sigh. At least Flan had remembered his name. Well, maybe he could not get away with doing the simplest chores for himself, but he was still responsible for the men eating beneath the trees. Without him, they would be with their families, getting ready for the day's chores around the farm, milking cows and cutting firewood instead of wondering whether they might have to kill or be killed before sunset. Gulping down the honeyed porridge quickly, he told Aram to take his ease over breakfast. But the man looked so miserable that he relented, so Aram followed as he made his way around the camp. The journey was not one Perrin enjoyed. Men put down their bowls when he approached, or even stood until he passed. He gritted his teeth whenever somebody he had grown up with, or worse, a man who had sent him on errands as a boy, called him Lord Perrin. Not everyone did, but too many. Far too many. After a time, he gave up telling them to stop out of sheer weariness. All too often the reply was, "Oh, whatever you say, Lord Perrin." It was enough to make a man howl. Despite that, he made himself pause to speak a word or two to every man. Mainly, though, he kept his eyes open, and his nose. They all knew well enough to keep their bows in good repair and tend the fletching and points on their arrows. But some would wear the soles out of their boots or the bottom out of their breeches without noticing, or let blisters fester because they could not be bothered to do anything about them just yet. Several had the habit of picking up brandy when they could, and two or three of those had no head for it at all. There had been a small village the day before reaching Bethal that held no fewer than three inns. It was very strange. Having Mistress Luhan or his mother tell him he needed new boots or his breeches mended had always been embarrassing, and he was sure he would have been irritated at the same from anybody else. But from grizzled old John Dinbaran on down, the Two Rivers men just said, "Why, right you are, Lord Perrin. I'll see to it straight away," or some such. He caught a number of them grinning at one another when he moved on. And they smelled pleased. When he rooted a clay jar of pear brandy out of Jory Conger's saddlebags, a skinny fellow who ate twice as much as anyone else and always looked as if he had not had a bite in a week, Jory was a good shot with a bow, but given a chance he would drink until he could not stand, and he had light fingers besides. Jory gave him a wide-eyed look and spread his hands as if he did not know where the jar had come from. But as Perrin walked on, emptying the brandy onto the ground, Jory laughed. "You can't put anything over on Lord Perrin." He sounded proud. Sometimes Perrin thought he was the only sane person left. Another thing he noticed. One and all, they were very interested in what he did not say. Man after man cast an eye toward the two banners that occasionally flapped atop their poles in a brief gust, Red Wolfhead and Red Eagle. They eyed the banners and watched him, waiting for the order he had given every time the things had come out since reaching Gil'dan. And often enough before that. Except that he had said nothing yesterday, and he said nothing today, and he saw speculation blooming on men's faces. He left behind clusters of men peering at the banners and at him, murmuring excitedly among themselves. He did not try to listen. What would they say if he was wrong, if the White Cloaks or King Auron decided they could look away from the Prophet and the Seanchan long enough to snuff out a supposed rebellion? They were his responsibility, and he had already gotten too many of them killed. The sun was more than peaking above the horizon, spreading a sharp morning light by the time he finished, and over at the tent, Talonvor and Lamgwin were lugging out chests under Linny's direction, while Megden and Brianna appeared to be sorting the contents out on a broad patch of dead grass, blankets and linens mainly, and long bright swaths of silk satin that had been intended to drape the bed he had misplaced. Fael must have been inside, because that gaggle of idiots were cooling their heels not far off. No carrying and hauling for them, useful as rats in the barn. Perrin thought about taking a look at Stayer and Stepper, but when he glanced through the trees at the horse lines, he was seen. No fewer than three of the farriers stepped out anxiously, watching him. They were blocky men in leather aprons, like as eggs in a basket, though Falton had only a fringe of white around his head, Aemon was graying, and Jerisid had not yet come into his middle years. Perrin growled at the sight of them. They would hover if he laid a hand on either horse, and goggle if he lifted a hoof. The one time he had tried to change a worn shoe, on Stayer, all six farriers had darted about, grabbing up tools before he could touch them, nearly knocking the bay over in their rush to do the work themselves.
"They're afraid you don't trust them," Aram said suddenly.
Perrin looked at him in surprise, and Aram shifted his shoulders in his coat.
"I've talked to them some. They think if a lord tends his own horses, it must be because he doesn't trust them. You might send them off with no way to get home."
His tone said they were fools to think that, but he gave Perrin a sideways glance and shrugged again uncomfortably.
"I think they're embarrassed, too. If you don't behave the way they think a lord should, it reflects on them as they see it."
"Light," Perrin muttered. Fael had said the same, about them being embarrassed anyway, but he had believed it just a lord's daughter talking. Fael had grown up surrounded by servants, yet how could a lady know the thoughts of a man who had to work for his bread? He frowned toward the horse lines. Five of the farriers stood together watching him now. Embarrassed that he wanted to look after his own horses, and upset that he did not want them pulling wool and scratching gravel all over the place. "Do you think I ought to act like a fool in silk small clothes?" he asked. Aram blinked and began studying his boots.
"Light," Perrin growled.
Spotting Basil Gil hurrying from the direction of the carts, Perrin moved to meet him. He did not think he had done very well at making Gil feel at ease yesterday. The stout man was talking to himself, and once more mopping his head with a kerchief, sweating away in a rumpled dark gray coat. The day's heat was beginning to take hold already. He did not see Perrin until Perrin was nearly on him, and then he gave a jump, stuffing the kerchief into a coat pocket and making a bow. He looked curried and brushed, fit for a feast day.
"Ah, my lord Perrin, your lady told me to take a cart into Bethal. She says I'm to find you some Two Rivers Tabak, if I can. But I don't know if that's possible. Two Rivers leaf has always been dear, and trade isn't what it was."
"She's sending you for tabak?" Perrin said, frowning. He supposed secrecy had gone down the well, but still.
"I bought three casks, two villages back. Enough for everybody."
Gil shook his head firmly.
"Not Two Rivers leaf, and your lady says you like that above any other. The Gil'danan leaf will do for your men. I'm to be your Shambayan," she called it, "and keep you and her supplied with what you need. Not much different from what I did running the blessing, really."
The similarity seemed to amuse him. His belly shook with quiet chuckles.
"I have quite a list, though I can't say how much of it I'll find. Good wine, herbs, fruit, candles and lamp oil cloth and wax, paper and ink, needles, pins, all sorts of things. Talonvor and Lamgwin and I are going, with some of your lady's other retainers."
his lady's other retainers. Talanvor and Lamgwin were bringing out yet another chest for the women to sort through. They had to pass by the squatting clump of young fools who never offered to lend a hand. In fact, the layabouts ignored them completely. "You keep an eye on that lot," Perrin cautioned. "If one of them starts any trouble, if he even looks as if he will, you have Lamgwin crack his head." And if it was one of the women? They were just as likely, maybe more so. Perrin grunted. Fael's retainers were going to tie his belly into permanent knots yet. Too bad she could not be satisfied with the likes of Master Gil and Megden. "You didn't mention Balwer, as he decided to go on alone?" Just then, a shift in the breeze brought him Balwer's scent, an alert smell very much at odds with the fellow's almost desiccated exterior. Even for so reedy a man, Balwer made surprisingly little noise on the dried leaves underfoot. In a sparrow brown coat, he offered a quick bow, and his tilted head added to the image of a bird.
"I am staying, my lord," he said cautiously.
Or maybe that was just his manner.
"As your gracious lady's secretary. And yours, if it pleases you."
He stepped closer, very nearly a hop.
"I am well versed, my lord. I possess a good memory and write a good hand, and my lord can be assured that whatever he confides in me will never pass my lips to another. The ability to keep secrets is a primary skill of a secretary. Don't you have pressing duties for our new mistress, Master Gil?"
Gil frowned at Balwer, opened his mouth, then closed it with a snap. Spinning on his heel, he trotted away toward the tent. For a moment, Balwer watched him go, head to one side, lips pursed thoughtfully.
"I can offer other services as well, my lord," he said finally. "Knowledge. I have overheard some of my lord's men speaking, and I understand that my lord may have had some difficulties with the Children of the Light. A secretary learns many things. I know a surprising amount about the children."
"With any luck, I can avoid White Cloaks," Perrin told him. "Better if you knew where the Prophet is, or the Seanchan."
He did not expect any of that, of course, but Balwer surprised him.
"I cannot be certain, of course, but I think the Seanchan have not spread far beyond Amador as yet. Fact is difficult to sift from rumor, my lord, but I keep my ears open. Of course, they do seem to move with unexpected suddenness. A dangerous people with large numbers of Terrabana soldiers. I believe from Master Gil that my lord knows of them, but I observed them closely in Amador, and what I saw is at my lord's disposal. As to the Prophet, there are as many rumors concerning him as the Seanchan, but I believe I can say reliably that he was recently at Abila, a largish town some 40 leagues south of here."
Balwer smiled thinly, a brief, self-satisfied smile.